Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
This is February 21st, 2010, and my name is Cecily Fiore. I'm going to do a Coming to the Path talk. I've always loved Coming to the Path talks. You know, it's kind of like hearing about how other people's parents met and got married. You know, you know how it's going to end, but the process is always kind of interesting. And I remember when I first started sitting, I was always really inspired by these people who had these really ferocious Coming to the Path talks where, you know, they were interested in Buddhism since the time they were 2 years old, and they looked far and wide, and finally they found the Zen Center. But this is not going to be like that at all. I literally wandered into this place, so I'm hoping I'm going to talk more about my background, and the actual Coming to the Path part is exciting but short, and hopefully I'll have time for questions so you guys can ask me brilliant questions that will somehow tie all this together. Where I'm from, if you ask about someone, the first thing you're gonna hear from people is where they come from and who their people are. And I think the idea is that, you know, you can tell a lot more about a person from that bit of information than from any particular fact about that individual. So that's where I'm gonna start. I grew up in Walla Walla, Washington, which does exist, and not just in Daffy Duck cartoons. Walla Walla is a very small town. It's actually not that small. It's like 20,000 people or so, but it's in the far southeastern corner of Washington State, and there's nothing else in that corner of Washington State or in the corner of Oregon that's near it or the side of Idaho that's near there. It's pretty much the only thing for miles, miles and miles. People think of Washington as this kind of rainy place with lots of coffee and high-tech companies and really cool like Seattle, but that's only, if you start at the ocean and you start driving east, like about 45 minutes, you hit a mountain range. And everything on the west side of that mountain range is Seattle and all the other kind of cool parts of Washington. And then everything east of that mountain range is completely different, both in terms of climate, culture, everything else. And I'm from that other side of Washington. There's on the west side of the mountains, it rains constantly in the wintertime. It's wet, it's cool, it's, you know, very moderate climate. As soon as you get over the mountains, it's dry as a bone, hot, hot summers, cold winters. Most of the state is basically just endless, endless miles of sagebrush and tumbleweed and canyons and kind of cowboy country. So Walla Walla is a valley surrounded all around the north and the west by that tumbleweed, and then to the south by these high mountains, the Blue Mountains, which are small mountains by Washington standards, but large mountains by New York State standards. The Adirondacks is what in Washington we would call hills. So growing up in this little town, it's being a Westerner it's kind of funny. I mean, I've lived back east for almost half my life now, for virtually all of my adult life, and it catches me in funny ways just how different culturally this part of the country is. It's like I always, my husband likes to say, you know, let's go walk in nature, you know, and I think people here think about that as, you know, nature is something you kind of go to, you know, you go to Ellison Park or you go to the Adirondacks. It's this place you kind of go and you experience, and growing up, it was like nature was everything else. You know, you had this little town where everyone you knew lived, but as soon as you left the town, you were out there with the bears and the mountain lions, and this real sense of your town as being something you kind of carve out. It's like that's where you want to be. Nature is the default. So Walla Walla is known for, well, and when I say known, I mean like known in Walla Walla pretty much, because it's not known for much of anything outside of Walla Walla. We grow enormous quantities of wheat. We elect a wheat queen every year. It's a very competitive thing. You're chosen based on your beauty, poise, and knowledge of wheat. I did not compete in that one. We have sweet onions. We're in a pitched cultural battle with Vidalia, Georgia, which is the other place that produces sweet onions. It's only after years that I can even say the V word, because Walla Wallans are not supposed to speak of it. We are noted for producing what used to be called rodeo clowns. They call them bullfighters now because that's really what they do. Those are the guys in the funny outfits who, when the bull bucks the cowboy off, they try and get the bull pissed off at them to attack them, and then they go hide in the barrel. I have no idea why Walla Walla is such a productive ground for rodeo clown production, but there it is. So, like I say, it's very isolated, and especially, you know, growing up, I grew up in the old days before the internet, and where, you know, really it's like the only things you knew about were the things that you saw day to day. You know, you couldn't get online and find out about what was going on in the world. You know, you had the evening news, but that was about it. And we didn't get a lot of people from outside of town. You know, we'd get the odd fertilizer salesman coming through every so often. But I remember once in high school, I was eating in a restaurant with one of my parents, and I remember, like, the next table over, there were German people, and they were speaking German with each other. And I was shocked. I mean, I was actually studying German in high school, but I intellectually knew that somewhere there were countries where people spoke like that, but I didn't really believe it on some level. So we never had tourists. We tried. There was one of the problems about being a farm town is your economy is really dependent on the price of whatever commodity is that you produce. And in our case, it was wheat. And so when wheat prices were up, everyone had a lot of money. And when wheat prices were down, people had less money. So the city fathers, and I say fathers because they were all guys, were always trying to get more people to come to Walla Walla. And the problem with that is there's not really anything to see in Walla Walla other than some high-quality topsoil and some nice scenery. And it's not on the way to any place, really. I mean, no matter where you're going, from any place of significance to any other place of significance, I guarantee you that Walla Walla is not on the way. So they tried various things. They spruced up the downtown. My favorite attempt that they made was when I was a kid. The only thing of any significance historically that ever happened in Walla Walla, it was sort of the major town in the Pacific Northwest back when there weren't any people in the Pacific Northwest, at least not white people. And there was a husband and wife missionaries. They were from the Finger Lakes area, actually. He was a doctor, and so they set up a medical mission near where Walla Walla is today, and you know, and provided medical care to the local tribes and then to settlers that were coming through from the east. And of course, because there were settlers coming in from the east, they were bringing diseases with them, and a lot of people in the tribes were dying of, you know, the usual, like smallpox and all the sort of diseases that the settlers were bringing. And so the medical mission was not going too well, and some of the local tribes had noticed that everyone seemed to be a lot sicker after the mission got there. So at one point, a group of kind of hothead young Cayuse warriors decided to take matters in their own hands, and they attacked the mission, and they massacred, you know, a huge number of people, including my great-great-great-some-greats uncle. So this was the only exciting thing that ever happened in Walla Walla. So some people in the city thought, okay, we got to leverage this into a tourism industry. And they took a typically boneheaded a try at it. They thought, okay, we're going to build an enormous outdoor amphitheater, you know, state of the art, seats hundreds of people, and we're going to do a musical of the Whitman Mission, which I remember thinking, wow, that's a great idea. I think everybody did. It was called Trails West! ! And I hear it was pretty good. I never saw it. I heard the actual massacre was staged as this kind of interpretive dance number, which may or may not have worked. I'm not sure. But, of course, no one came to see the musical version of the Whitman Mission Massacre. So we were left with this kind of white elephant amphitheater out on the edge of town and no tourists. So there actually are tourists now, but it was kind of accidental. Like, people started growing wine grapes. And they discovered that wine grapes grow really well, and people started making incredible wine, and now people come from all over the world to drink Walla Walla wine. So farming saved us in the end. But back when I was a kid, there wasn't any of that. So the advantage of growing up in this tiny, isolated place, when I was a teenager, it made me insane, of course, because I wanted nothing more than to get the hell out of there. But it was a great place to grow up. There's a great country song called "Everybody Dies Famous in a Small Town," and it's true. You know, I think I was probably in the local paper like 10 times before I even hit high school, just because I was kind of cute and I had freckles, and so I'd get in photographs a lot. And it was very, very safe. I mean, I was raised to trust all adults absolutely, especially the ones wearing uniforms, and I walked to school, which was almost a mile, starting in, I think, first grade, walked back and forth by myself. I got lost once, and I just knocked on the door of the nearest house and asked the lady to call my mom, and she made me cookies and mm-hmm. introduced me to her cat, Pumpkin. And, mm-hmm. you know, and it never occurred to me that the world was a dangerous place at all. If anything, it was too safe. It was a little too boring. So also growing up in the West, there's a really strong kind of a libertarian tradition that comes out in me in some funny ways. You know, it's like I have this, some of my friends are amused by this irrational hatred I have of toll highways. They make me crazy. It's like I know that it's good, you know, we got to pay for the roads and it's good for the people who use them to pay for them. I intellectually understand it, but there's some part of me that is convinced that highways are given to us by God, and it's my right as an American to drive down them whenever I feel like. Same thing with gun control. You know, I'm absolutely, positively pro-gun control, but there's some part of me that just feels like I ought to be able to keep firearms in my closet. I don't know. It's inexplicable. So I had pretty standard Walla Walla childhood. I, you know, learned how to ride a horse and shoot a gun. My dad taught me how to shoot when I was, like, 7, you know, went to the rodeo and did all those things, worked in the agricultural industry in many different unpleasant capacities. So my family, my people, both of my parents are native Washingtonians from some generations back. Washington's, you know, it's like a lot of Western states. There are a lot of people who move there because it's a lovely place. But there's a few of us who have been there for a while. My mom grew up in this kind of matriarchy. It was like my grandmother and my grandmother's sister both had only daughters, and so all them and all their daughters all kind of lived in the same neighborhood, and then in my generation they all had only boys except for me. So I grew up with all these older women and their husbands, and then me and 15 boy cousins playing in the woods out in Seattle. And they were long-time Seattle family. There were some words in my vocabulary growing up that I got from my family that I realized when I went off to college that no one understood what they meant. And I found out later they were words from the old Chinook trading jargon, which was kind of the lingua franca of the Northwest. And it still survived in funny places in some of these families, but only there. And so, you know, there's little traces of the old days here and there. So she went to college in Walla Walla. She grew up near Seattle and in Seattle. Went to college in Walla Walla, and I think that's why she and my dad moved back there. My mother is the ultimate people person. She's kind of a savant, you know, like you get these kind of savants who can calculate numbers and tell you what day of the week it was in, you know, the year 827 and on March 27th. My mom is like that with interpersonal relationships. She has this gift. Okay, just as an example, she was traveling in Costa Rica a couple years ago, and she was waiting in line at this little airport in Costa Rica, and she struck up a conversation with this young woman who was in front of her in the line. And in the 10 minutes that it took them to move up to the counter, my mother had discovered that this young woman had previously been the tenant of a basement apartment owned by this guy who used to date Abby Levin in Juneau, Alaska. And my mom had met Abby once. And yet she retained everything about Abby's interpersonal web of connections in her head and managed to place this girl in her worldview. any place I go in the world, my mother has someone I can stay with. It's like, you're going to Nairobi? Well, you know, I had this college roommate who had a cousin who married a guy who, you know, it's absolutely incredible to me. So unsurprisingly, she became a school counselor. She was the counselor, not at my high, there are two high schools in my hometown. I went to the big high school, the public high school. My mom worked at this small private high school. It was a junior and a senior high school together, a Catholic school. And she got a weird mix of students because, you know, about half of the students were kids from, you know, some of these big Catholic farming families who grew up with, you know, 12 brothers and sisters, and they all went to this little Catholic school. And then the other half of the students were kids who had gotten kicked out of the public schools. That was their only other educational option. So when I got older and I went off to college and all my friends at college had been to private schools, I was like, why'd they make you go to private school? I was like, what did you do? I just thought private school was for juvenile delinquents. So my mom, you know, as the counselor, knew everything about everyone, and dinner time was always these stories, you know, never any names attached. I didn't know the kids, so I think she spoke freely. I learned a lot about human beings, things that never, you know, just teen pregnancy and drug use and incest and just all the stuff that was going on, you know, that was way outside my personal experience, but I got some kind of exposure to it anyway. So my dad, the Feuers are kind of an interesting family. They got to Washington a little later than my mom's family, but they were Westerners for years and years. My great-great-great-grandfather, I think, was in the Prussian military and was a doctor and emigrated to the U.S. and apparently was a spy for Prussia and was, like, assassinated in his medical office. There's some whole, like, sordid family story there. But after that, the Feuers started going west, and they were real, always just on the outer edge of the frontier. My aunt sent me this great, it was my great-great-grandfather's obituary, and they were one of the first families in South Dakota, and they were there during all the, you know, after Little Bighorn with all the Sioux conflicts, and just crazy, crazy stories. And finally, they ended up, my great-grandfather and my grandfather ended up working on the railroad, and they built the bridges that carried the trains all the way from the Dakotas into Washington. And my great-grandfather actually became an engineer on the Seattle to Portland Passenger Express, which at the time is sort of like the equivalent of being a Pan Am international route pilot in the 60s. You know, it's one of these really glamorous jobs for a guy to have. And I've got this great picture of him with his hat cocked back, and he's leaning against the door of his train, and he looks cocky as hell. One of my favorite photos. So my grandfather started as a lumberjack and worked in a sawmill for most of his life. My dad started working there too, worked his way through college there, but he did go to college and got his master's degree, and he ended up teaching at the community college in Walla Walla, first teaching and then as an administrator. It was kind of an odd job because he was a medievalist, so that was what he loved, was medieval epics, but he ended up, you know, as an administrator, he's the dean of academics, so he was doing everything. I mean, you know, administering the hay budget for the rodeo department. He also taught writing at the state penitentiary, which was in Walla Walla. And this was, the state penitentiary, you know, like Ted Bundy was there at one point. There were a lot of bad, bad, you know, like guys who had axe murdered their families, all these dreadful people. And my dad loved teaching them. He said they were, compared to his regular community college students, they were enthusiastic. They were really glad to be there. So that was his favorite teaching job. So it was funny having parents as teachers. I found out much later in life that they both used me in their classes. My mom used to teach psychology classes in the high school, and apparently I was used as an example on many occasions, which I was later told by some of her students. My dad was even worse. He knew I was a voracious reader, so he would, if he had a book coming up for one of his classes that he thought his students would complain about, he used to leave it out so that I would pick it up and read it, And then I was later told by one of his students, then he would say, well, my daughter read this book. I don't know why you have such a problem with it. This person was like, we all hated you. Thanks, Dad. So they got divorced when I was fairly young, which was hard. Divorce is always hard. But they were, I think they were very, looking back as an adult, they were very careful parents in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly in the divorce, you know, I think back at how, you know, I look at friends of mine, you know, my age who have gone through divorces and how difficult it is and how hard it is to stay civil. And I think back at my parents and how good they were with me and my brother. It was just amazing to me. And my dad, fortunately, my dad, when they did divorce, he stayed in town, and so I just grew up with both of them. And they both ended up remarrying happily, long-term marriages. So they were very supportive, but they had this kind of weird, they were both kind of obsessed with not influencing me too much. You know, I had friends in high school whose parents, you know, informed them that they were going to go to medical school, of course, and that was their only option, which was weird. I mean, my parents never, I found out much later in life, I was actually studying at, I was in college, I was getting a conservatory degree. You know, I was a very serious musician. And I was looking through my dad's old yearbooks. I thought I was the only freak in my conservatory class who came from a totally non-musical family. All my classmates came from these musical families. I thought, it's weird. Neither of my parents are musical. I was going through my dad's yearbooks, and it was clear from the things that his friends had written in the yearbooks that he was this astonishing piano player. And so I quizzed him about it, and it turns out he was an incredibly good piano player. He had to give it up when he went to college because he was working his way through college and he didn't have time to play. But I was like, Dad, why didn't you ever tell me this? And he's like, well, I didn't want to influence you. I was like, what? That's crazy. So that was a little peculiar, but it did let me kind of find my own peculiar way. Then the other member of my family was my brother, Matthew. We didn't have him for very long. He died of cancer when he was 7 years old. He developed a brain tumor, a bad one, a glioblastoma, the same kind Ted Kennedy got. And so he died within a year. And that was obviously, I mean, you can imagine how difficult that was for us. Again, you see the good side of living in this kind of tiny town where everyone knows your business. You know, the positive side of that is that when you're going through a hard time, everybody knows about it. You know, I think we ate nothing but other people's casseroles for something like 6 months, you know. But it did make me very, one of the things I remember the most about that time is how, I think when you're a kid, you're very sensitive to your parents, you know, especially like your parents' distress or anger or anything like that. And I remember being almost shocked by how upset my parents were because, you know, again, this sort of traditional Western culture, it's like everyone is, all the adults are kind of solid for the kids. You know, you want to create this stable environment. And I always had this very stable environment, and it continued to be stable. But I realized that my parents were human beings, and it was pretty shocking. So, I developed this habit of never telling them when there was something, you know, difficult going on. I remember once when I was, this must have been middle school or so, I came down with a bad case of pneumonia. And I always had, you know, various respiratory ailments, but this one was pretty bad and I felt horrible. And I remember my mom took me to the doctor and I was sitting in the waiting room and there was a poster up on the wall, like my mom was, I don't know, getting my antibiotics or something from the pharmacy, and there was this poster on the wall. It was probably some poster to, like, get you to buckle your kids up with seatbelts or something, and it was listing the top causes of death for children under 16, something like that. You know, and number one was car accidents, and number two was, I don't know, accidents in the home, and like, somewhere around number five was pneumonia, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have a fatal disease. And I thought, okay, so the doctor and my mom aren't telling me because they don't want me to be upset. You know, I was probably a little feverish. So I was not thinking very clearly. And the first thing I thought was, I can't let on that I know the truth. So I spent the next 2 weeks like on the couch waiting to get worse, and you know, and being very brave, and you know, keeping my spirits up. And then of course I got better and felt ridiculous, but so all right, so I haven't talked about myself at all, at least not directly. So let me switch to that. As I was prepping for this, I was very disappointed. I couldn't find this document. My mom sent me this piece of paper a couple years ago, and it was from the school district psychologist back when I was in kindergarten. No, when I was in first grade. I started school and I already knew how to read. I was very bored in class and was apparently very articulate about how bored I was. So they were thinking about bumping me up a grade. So as part of that whole process, they had me evaluated by the school psychologist. And so she sent me this report he did. It was just this one-page report. And, you know, it was unbelievably enlightening, because basically I have not changed at all since I was six. You know, I can't, unfortunately I couldn't find it, so I can't quote it for you, but it's like, Cecily is a curious and very lively child. And by lively, I think I just talked his ear off. You know, but everything's down there, like all of my personality quirks, all of my, you know, at one point he's like, She reads very voraciously, but because she goes so quickly through things, her comprehension is not as deep as it could be. And I was like, oh, damn. So basically, you know, you get the set of traits that you start out with, and you can only do so much with them. But I was very curious. According to my mother, I don't remember any of this. I taught myself, well, when I was about 2 and a half or so, I became intensely interested in Sesame Street, like unnaturally so. So I used to sit in front of the TV watching Sesame Street or The Electric Company, all those reading shows, with this look of ferocious intensity on my face. And one day when I was three, she always took me to the library for a Saturday story hour, and, you know, came back with a big pile of books, and she'd always read to me. One day we'd come back from the library, and she noticed I was really quiet in the other room, and she went in there, and I was reading. Like a parent, she was like, you taught yourself how to read. I don't know how you did it. So I don't remember what prompted that, but I do remember a little later when I was in, I don't know, I must have been like six or seven, my grandmother had this set of Babar the Elephant books. I don't know if people have seen these. They're these sort of adorable, elegant little kids' books. I love them. And most of them were, you know, kind of standard children's book with the pictures and then the printed text. But there was one of them that was, the text wasn't printed. It was like handwritten in cursive writing. And I couldn't read it. And I do remember that. I remember very distinctly how unbelievably frustrating that was. The idea that this book was saying something and I couldn't read it. And I used to spend hours like staring at this book, looking at the pictures and trying to, you know, it was like I was working on the Rosetta Stone or something, trying to decipher this cursive. So I'm sure that was what prompted the reading. You know, I just couldn't bear the thought that I couldn't understand books. So books became really just so important to me. The Walla Walla Public Library, I mean, I look at it now and it's a dumpy little place, but it was the center of my existence. I was so curious, and I had this idea in my head that if I could read every book in the public library, I would know everything. So I actually tried once. I set myself a program. I was going to start at one end of the library and just read my, I had no idea how long this was going to take, but I figured, you know, then I'd know everything, and that would be worth doing. So, unfortunately, it was organized on the Dewey Decimal System, and I don't know, you people who aren't librarians, the 000s of the Dewey Decimal System are like the World Almanac, and, you know, who's who in Canadian literature, and, you know, all these horrendously boring reference books. So I got, like, about halfway through the first book and gave it up as a bad lot. But I read everything. I read the medieval epics that my dad left lying around the house. I read topography. I read everything. I remember this great moment. It was probably like the most important moment of my thinking life. I had become obsessed with Chariots of the Gods. You know, this book, this guy, Eric von Daniken, this was the 70s, of course, right? So there are all these kind of books being written. And this guy, his thesis was that aliens came to Earth and gave us basically everything that we have that's anything resembling civilization, and there's proof everywhere. And it's like, you know, the Nazca lines in Peru, you could only see them from up in the air, so how could they do them? So I was absolutely obsessed with this book. It was completely compelling to me. You know, I'm probably age 8 or 9 at this point. But next to Chariots of God of the Gods on the library shelf was another book that some, bless this man, I don't know his name, I should find him and write him a thank you note if he's still alive. He had actually bothered, he was some professor in Iowa or something, and he had actually bothered to take the time to sit down and write a book that was a point-by-point refutation of Chariots of the Gods, saying, you know, I know this guy, this carving sort of looks like a guy in a rocket ship, but look at all these other carvings that show similar things, and you can see that's not a rocket ship. It's actually a tree, and the guy's falling. He's not in, like, a spacesuit. And he just went through this point by point. And I read this book, and I was absolutely flabbergasted because it had never occurred to me that something that was in a book could not be true. I just took... And yet, here were two books, and they said two totally different things. I'm still working out the implications of that. You know, and then later in life, reading books got me through junior high, specifically the collected journals of Allen Ginsberg, I remember, were very eye-opening to me when I was 12 years old. I was very, very musical. It was another thing. I kind of taught myself how to read music, but then I learned any number of instruments, flute, percussion, saxophone. I had a jazz band in high school, backing up a Frank Sinatra impersonator at one point. I was sort of a semi-professional musician by the last couple of years. I played actually at the Trails West Amphitheater. they did start doing regular summer musicals, which, as far as I could tell, were selected. Like, they wouldn't pick a musical unless it had parts for children and opportunities to have livestock on stage. That's it. Like, every musical production, you know, Oklahoma, everyone was riding actual horses, you know, Brigadoon, you're in this Scottish village. Oh, look, here comes a herd of sheep down the hill. So I used to play in the pit orchestra for that. And recorder, too, which is the instrument I ended up actually studying at the conservatory. It was... I just kind of picked it up, again, because it was lying around the house. I think my mom had bought one at one point because it was the 60s and everyone bought recorders back then. It was like one of those groovy, folky things to do. She never played it, but I found it and learned it and started playing with an early music group in high school and then went on. And I always think, I know here at the center we get a lot of folks from the Eastman School, which doesn't surprise me in the slightest because, you know, music is, especially when you do it seriously, it's this, you know, ideally it's a self-imposed discipline. So, you know, no one's making you sit down and practice, at least not once you're out of grade school. And it teaches you to sit in a room staring at a wall and doing the same thing over and over and over again, which is a great help for practice. And it just teaches you focus and discipline and to have a high tolerance for failing for long periods of time before you finally get the hang of things. So it's helped me this whole time. As far as religion, I haven't talked about Buddhism at all because I had zero exposure to Buddhism. I'm not even sure if I had heard of Buddhism until I went to college. I mean, again, this is a very small, very rural American Western town, prayer at the football games kind of place. So there were no Buddhists. There were no people thinking about Buddhism. I was raised Episcopalian, kind of high church. So I was an altar girl. We had robes and bowing and lots of candles, way more candles than we have here. And they had to be lit in the correct order and extinguished in the correct order. So the level of formality here, to me, is nothing. We got nothing on the Episcopalians, let me tell you. So I love the forms of it. Most Episcopalian churches have a lot of music. I mean, we would have, on a Sunday, we'd have the adult choir, the children's choir, and the handbell choir, and these very elaborate ceremonies. We'd pray for the Archbishop of Canterbury every week. I wasn't even sure who the Archbishop of Canterbury was, but I prayed for him on a weekly basis. But it never quite, I never quite synced with the whole God thing. I was very religious, and I think I was, the forms of ritual really appealed to me, and I had a lot of religious feeling, but it never quite synced up. Like, I never quite managed to put that religious feeling into the religion that I was ostensibly a member of. So it was, in high school, I thought about going to seminary because I had such a strong attraction to religious life, but the whole not believing in God thing I thought was probably kind of a deal killer for seminary. So I never pursued it. And then, so high school, I was frothing to get out of Walla Walla. I could not wait. When I was in high school, I joined like student groups solely because I knew that at the end of the year they would have a field trip, like a weekend in Seattle. So I would join them and spend all year going to the meetings just so I could get to Seattle for that one weekend. So when I went off to college, my goal was to get almost as far away as I could. I ended up all the way in Ohio. I had never, I think until I went to college, other than when I was a baby, I had never been east of the Rocky Mountains. I had absolutely no experience of the East Coast at all. And then I went to college, and there were all these people from New York City. I was like, wow, they're really like that. I thought it was just a TV thing, you know? But no, here they are. I had my first real bagel. I was like, oh, this isn't anything like the bagels in Walla Walla, which were kind of like dinner rolls with a hole in the middle. It was not, I was mocked a lot my first year of college. college was absolute heaven to me. I mean, for the first time, I found people who were interested in jazz. They were interested in Allen Ginsberg. They were interested in all the things I was interested in and had never, you know, none of my friends back home. When I was growing up, I would often have friendships with adults, actually, because those were the people I could find who wanted to talk about the certain specific nerdy things I wanted to talk about. So college was great. I did a double degree program. I was there for 5 years. So I got a Bachelor of Arts in English from the college, and I got a Bachelor of Music in Recorder from the conservatory. And then after I graduated from college, I really had no idea what I wanted to do with myself. I just, you know, I think I was just too young and I hadn't sorted myself out. I mean, I still haven't really sorted myself out, but I really had no clue. So I sort of defaulted to graduate school in English. I knew I didn't want to be a musician because, believe it or not, I didn't like practicing. and I wanted a sort of a more steady, normal job with a paycheck, you know, and the life of a musician is difficult in a lot of ways, especially a recorder player. You know, it's not like you can join a symphony and get a paycheck that way. You're going to have kind of a weird career no matter what. So I went to graduate school in English at University of Rochester, and that was how I got to Rochester. And I love teaching. You know, when you're a PhD student in English, you teach a lot of freshman English classes. So that part of it I loved. I hated academia. It just, in some ways it's a really good life, but it always struck me as like a whole bunch of really bright people with not enough to do. And that leads to a lot of kind of weird conflicts and like turf battles and very strange life. And I was like, I didn't know this. I didn't think this was really for me. But again, I didn't know what else to do with myself. So I did a fair chunk of the PhD program. I wasn't quite ABD, all but dissertation, but I was very close to it. And again, I didn't know what to do with myself. So I was pretty sure I didn't want to be an academic, but I didn't have any better ideas. So I kind of coasted along in that for a little while. And okay, so here's the coming to the path part. So the sum total of my knowledge of Buddhism at this point was, I had heard of Buddhism, and I had heard of Zen Buddhism, and I knew it was an Asian religion, and I knew there was meditation involved. And that's literally, I think, all I knew about Buddhism. I had no particular interest at all. So I was living off of Monroe Avenue, kind of behind Arkhamage, like on one of those little side streets, and I had been assigned, instead of the usual freshman teaching at the U of R campus, I had been assigned to teach the first semester of humanities at the Eastman School. This was kind of like a special assignment that they would only give certain people because apparently some prior graduate students had had kind of little mini nervous breakdowns trying to teach these musicians. But they figured I had a music degree so I could handle them somehow. And they were great. I mean, you just had to be a bigger diva than they were in front of the classroom and you were fine. So I was teaching at Eastman and it was winter. It was around this time of year, actually, I think. January, February, maybe December. And I had this little Volkswagen Bug that my dad had got for me in Walla Walla, and we had driven across the country in the middle of winter to get to Rochester. It was a 1973 Beetle. I was very fond of it. And one day, I got up, and I went to go get in my car, and my car had this... It had been hit by a snowplow. And I know it was a snowplow because the dent in the back fender was kind of, the bottom of the dent was straight and the top of the dent was angled like this. And it was about 2 feet off the ground. I was like, yeah, that's a snowplow. So it was kind of a hit and run. And I had to put it in the body shop, but it was there for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I had to walk to work. So I was walking from Monroe Avenue to the Eastman School every day. And just to entertain myself, I used to go down different side streets and vary the track a little bit. And I started walking down Arnold Park just because it was convenient. And, you know, remember, I was in this point in my life where I didn't know what to do with myself. And I was kind of stressed out and unhappy and not sure what I was up to. And so I walked by this Zen Center sign. And I thought, Zen, they do that meditation thing, don't they? And, you know, and then I kept walking. And this went on for some weeks. And finally, I thought, you know, I wonder if I should do this meditation thing. I thought, I'll get a book, because this is how I've always done things in my life, right? You want to know something, you find yourself a book. So, this was the one other thing I knew about Zen Buddhism, that there was this guy named Suzuki who had written some books. Somehow that little tidbit of information had gotten into my head. So I went to the bookstore. And I went to the religion section, and I looked under Suzuki, and fortunately for me, I was obviously thinking of D.T. Suzuki, you know, the writer who wrote a lot of more sort of scholarly things about Zen, but the book I picked up was by Shunryu Suzuki. It was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is the perfect book for someone who's thinking about getting into meditation and has never really thought of it before. And I read it, and I was like, wow, this Suzuki guy, this is kind of cool. So the next time I walked by the Zen Center, I knocked on the door, and I was like, can you guys teach me to meditate? Mm-hmm. And they were like, sure, come to a workshop. So I did, and that was it. And now 15 years later, I literally wandered up the street and wandered into the building, but it seems to have done the trick. So if you've come to Zen through some kind of random half-assed way, do not despair. There is a place for you. So I'm going to stop and see if folks have questions.
Who answered the door?
It was Karen Lowry, I think. Yeah.
How did you become an attorney, though?
Oh, well... That's the staying on the path talk, which, as Brenda said to me once, she's like, you know, the staying on the path talks would be a lot more interesting than the coming to the path talks. Yeah, that was, I was not that long after I joined the center initially, like maybe a year later, I actually realized that I would much rather be doing that than academia, so I actually came on staff for a while. And then I met my husband, and then, you know, you marry people, and then you want to kind of have a life that doesn't involve, you know, staying in one room in a house with a bunch of other people. So at some point, we decided to move back to the West Coast, and I thought, I'll go to law school. Why not? I didn't know any lawyers growing up, you know, because again, who needs lawyers? You need a lawyer to write your will, but no one ever sues anyone in Walla Walla. So really the only people I knew who were lawyers were, you know, like, people here, like Tom Roberts and Casey Frank, and my friend Abby went to law school, and I thought, wow, lawyers are cool. And, you know, once I became a lawyer, I found out that they're actually not all that cool, but but I just happened to know some good ones, so that was what prompted it. I highly recommend Zen practice as prep for law school. I really, it's like the best. Being on staff for a little while, law school's easy after that.